So this afternoon, I'd really like us to give some attention to this quality of metta and our understanding of it and the place that it plays both in our own meditative development but also in our relational lives. So I'd like to begin, if I may, by reading. I know this sutta will be familiar to many of you, but even so, it is worth revisiting. To reach the state of peace, one skilled in the good should be capable and upright, easy to speak to and straightforward, of gentle nature and not proud, contented and easily supported, living lightly and having few duties, wise and with senses calmed, not arrogant and without greed for supporters, and should not do the least thing that the wise would later reproach them for. One should reflect in this way. May all beings be happy and secure. May all beings be happy-minded. Whatever living beings there may be, whether weak or strong, tall, large, medium or short, small or big, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they, without exception, be happy-minded. Let no one despise another or deceive anyone anywhere. Let no one, through anger or hatred, wish for another's suffering. As a mother would risk her life to protect her child, her only child, so for all beings should one guard one's boundless heart. With boundless friendliness for the whole world, to cultivate a boundless heart in all directions, without obstruction, without hate, and without ill will. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, whenever one is awake, may one stay with this recollection. This is called the best and most sublime way of dwelling in this world. One who is virtuous, endowed with insight, not clinging to wrong view, and having overcome all passion for sensual pleasure, will not come to lie in a womb again. I mean, in many ways, I think if we had more time, it would be actually worthwhile unpacking this discourse line by line, because actually there is so much held within it. This is a translation recently done by a Pali scholar who is in agreement with, actually, I think most of the best Pali scholars that I know. And I don't know if you noticed, but there's one adjustment in this translation from the ones that you're probably most accustomed to. With boundless friendliness for the whole world, should one cultivate... As a mother would risk her own life to protect her child, her only child, so for all beings, one should guard one's boundless heart. Slightly different than the translations you're used to, where it would say, so should one protect all living beings. The Buddha's very much pointing towards this ongoing responsibility to guard, not to defend, but to guard one's boundless heart. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, the Metta Sutta is found in a collection of discourses called the Sutta Nipata, which I think by most scholars is recognized probably as being the earliest teachings of the Buddha and somewhat perhaps the most reliable in terms of actually having been offered in that way. Now, this word metta, the reason why I've chosen to use the word metta rather than to translate it into English is because it is simply so difficult to translate. It has its origins in the root maitri, which means to be a friend to or to befriend. It also has a connotation of spreading out with kindness, or almost growing plump with kindness. It has that kind of connotation in the Pali of metta. Now, I think, and this is a process word. It's not, you know, Pali is very much a language of verbs, of process. It's not a language of states. So metta here is a quality of befriending probably captures it most accurately, the befriending process. I think it's very important to think of metta not as a state, not as an emotion, but as a relational way of being with all things. It's a relational way of being. Now, I know we have inherited mostly the translation loving kindness, and you know, I don't really want to get into an argument with that translation except to say it's inaccurate. Sorry. The word in Pali, love, for love, is very different than metta. And the only, you know, although I think it's fine to use that translation, in my experience it's also really important to acknowledge that it's a translation that I have found excludes many people from this practice. People tell me that they cannot practice metta because they're under the belief that they should be able to love what they find in their experience to be unlovable. So, you know, and I think I can really recognize that for someone who's living with trauma, you know, to suggest that they should be able to find some loving kindness for this may be just actually simply too big an ask. You know, for someone who's living with chronic pain or illness or grief or loss, you know, to suggest that they maybe should be able to find some loving kindness for this, I feel is, sometimes to me it feels almost abusive. You know, it feels almost cruel. But for some people, they tell me then this excludes them from the practice. Whereas to suggest they may not have to love this at all, but they may be able to stand near to it, knowing that also the effects of fleeing from the difficult equally has a toxic effect inwardly. The possibility of being able to stand near to, possibly even to befriend or to form a relational way of being which is not laced with fear or with aversion actually makes this somewhat possible for people. Metta, as I mentioned earlier, very much is developing hand in hand with sati or mindfulness. As the Buddha says in the discourse, to resolve upon this mindfulness, to resolve upon this mindfulness during one's waking hours, may one be mindful of this heart and this way of living that is the most noble in the world. So mindfulness, I think, as we recognize, is pretty much the antidote to heedlessness or forgetfulness, including the forgetfulness of the very pivotal place that metta occupies. Mindfulness, a part of mindfulness, is this wonderful Pali word, apalapala. It's great, isn't it? Apalapala. It means not to float away. It means not to float away. And I find that this is such a significant factor of mindfulness and of metta, that we don't float away, we don't become forgetful, we don't become heedless, that we're able to bear this in mind. To bear this in mind, apalapala. So you're developing your apalapala skills as you develop mindfulness and sati. Now, when we think about it, the proximate causes of forgetfulness, they're basically the five hindrance factors. Craving for sensual pleasure, aversion, dullness, numbness, agitation, worry, doubt. These are the primary saboteurs of intention in our life. If you look at any moments of real forgetfulness, when you are forgetful of and want to be forgetful of both mindfulness and metta, you will probably see the hindrance factors operating in the center of that storm. These are what makes our attention float away. And I know those of you who are very experienced in meditative practice, you know, think of the hindrance factors and can easily think about them as meditation issues, you know, that you're supposed to get over if you're a good meditator. These are not meditation issues. These are life concerns. These are the mental states. These are the patterns that make us float away and that sabotage intentionality. And I really encourage you to reflect on that in your own experience any moment in today, you know, where you've suddenly found yourself forgetful or suddenly found yourself being reactive or, you know, simply suddenly found yourself being lost. Try and check out which of the hindrance factors was really at play in those moments. So these are our primary forgetfulness factors that actually sabotage the intentionality and then our capacity to sustain attention. So when the intentionality falls away, as I mentioned earlier today, the attention drops and we float away. Isn't it true? You know, probably most of us go out of our homes in the morning, you know, or go into the world with some degree of intentionality about being a reasonably kind person or reasonably sane person even, you know, until the bus is late, you know, or until we get in that traffic jam, you know, or until we meet the person at work, you know, who says something that offends us, you know. You notice how the intention just floats away, you know, and is often just replaced by one of the hindrance factors. So as we're developing both sati, mindfulness, and we're developing metta, we're really acknowledging that we're developing this in this classroom of the hindrance factors. We're learning to remember to befriend. We're learning to remember to be present and to be awake. And this is no easy task. Now, as I mentioned earlier, if we were to use, you know, the tradition, being aware that this word loving kindness, by the way, the first wave of translators who started to translate this material from the Pali, they very much used the word friendliness and befriending. It's only later translators that actually began to introduce the phrase loving kindness. So that's a much newer kid on the block. It's a much newer kid on the block, despite it having become very institutionalized in our Dharma world. So, as we touched upon earlier today, two ways of developing metta practice. One way as a samadhi practice, which I think we talked about the benefits of this morning, and also of the limitations of. Using it as an insight practice. Again, you know, if you read the Metta Sutta, you know, you don't see any reference to oneself, benefactor, good friend, difficult person, neutral person. I mean, you know, if we were to use the discourses, you know, we'd be thinking, may all big people be well and happy, may all small people be well and happy. You know? So, we'd be using very, very different phrases. So, but this is skillful means, you know, and I don't want to belittle it, but I think it's really important to contextualize this, you know, that the practices that we use were very much kind of later additions. You know, the Buddha was not a technique man. You know, he actually did not deliver much in the way of technique apart from mindfulness of breathing and providing some references for developing mindfulness. So, you know, forever people have struggled actually to put the Buddha's teachings into something practical that they could actually engage in. You know, so the metta practice as we've inherited it, using phrases and using categories, I think we can put within the context of skillful means or ways of remembering. Ways of remembering. Ways of remembering the importance of metta. And so we're learning to sustain our attention within metta by using some of the phrases that many of you will be familiar with. You know, may I be peaceful? May you be peaceful. May I live with ease and with calm. May I live with kindness. May you live with kindness. So the phrases are very much in this context of being a skillful means to help us stop floating away. Help us stop floating away. So if we were to use this as an insight practice, again, you know, the phrases are really only articulated intentions. But so we would learn to drop them in and to listen inwardly, to our own responses. And I think in listening inwardly, often what we discover is our own self-story about what I like and what I don't like. You know, what I'm anxious about, what I think about you, what I think about myself, you know. So we're often discovering our own self-story. And, you know, in using the metta practice, we might be reminded of how much, as human beings, we actually truly long for happiness. We actually truly long for peace. We long for a way of relating to this world that is permeated with kindness and with friendliness. And we also, as we listen inwardly, we discover the ways in which we find ourselves sabotaging those longings or finding our attention floating away about those longings. But metta is not about fixing the self story. It's about choosing where we make our home and whether we're going to choose to make our home in that self story, that other story, or whether we're going to choose to make our home in our capacity for befriending and being able to sustain that intentionality. Does that make sense to you? So metta practice as we inherit it, and I really do keep using these phrases, you know, as we inherit it, because we do inherit it in particular ways. It often begins with actually ourselves. But, you know, this is difficult for a lot of people. This is where they get the most obstacles, you know, around themselves, you know. Yes, I wish to be happy. No, I don't deserve to be happy. Maybe I can't be happy, you know. Maybe I'm unworthy of happiness, you know. And maybe I need to become this before I can be happy, you know. So for many people, self and the difficult person are actually interchangeable categories within metta practice, you know. And personally, I would never actually suggest in metta practice that you start with the most difficult. I actually think that you start with what is easy, with what actually comes most unhesitatingly. So I when I teach metta, I never start with self, because, you know, for so many people, they're immediately in hot water, you know, and they found, you know, they find it just really, really hard, because the self story is so dense and so complex, you know, so immediately it can start setting off all kinds of you know, narratives. So I actually tend to, as many ways I teach metta practice, I don't have one way of teaching metta practice, but I find with all the different domains of metta practice, there's an internal dimension and there's an external dimension. You know, you think about a benefactor. Well, you know, I think about the people I'm grateful to in my life. But then I also think about the ways that I can be a benefactor to others. I also think about the ways that I am a benefactor or not to myself. You know, I think about the good friend. You know, I think about the, you know, the nature of friendship, the people whose friendship I appreciate in this life. I think about what it is to be a friend to others. I think about what it is to be a friend to myself. So I you know, I'm a little hesitant about making these practices so cut and dried, you know, or simplistic in a way. You know, when I think about the difficult person, or you think about the difficult person, well, you might be struggling to choose which one. But, you know, then you think about, oh no, this is about the difficulties also that I have in relationship to this person. And I think, oh, this is about the difficulties I have in relationship to my own being. You know, so here we're actually exploring many, many landscapes as we cultivate metta practice. When the Buddha talked about metta, you know, it's very clear in the sutta, he's speaking about bringing ill will to an end. About bringing ill will to an end. Appreciating the toxicity of ill will in our lives, whether it's directed inwardly or whether it's directed outwardly. We only need to look at the sort of the language and the conversation in our cultures and our societies to appreciate the divisive nature of ill will and how this is the breeding ground for self and other. How this is the fertile breeding ground for self and other. Now we recognize it if we look carefully in our own experience, that, you know, there is no self that has an independent existence. You know, the sense of self is always relational to an other. It's always arising and passing in relationship to an other. Now, when that arising is actually flavored by ill will, we have what we experience too much of in our world today, of hatred and mistrust and isms, you know, all of the isms and the separations and the alienation and the mistrust and the blame and the shame and the judgment, the whole package of ill will. Most of us would not get up in the morning and decide this is a good day for ill will. You know. And yet doesn't it seem to be sort of one of our most embedded and ingrained habit patterns that just sort of ambushes us at times, you know? Sometimes in little ways and sometimes in very big ways. You know, most of us probably don't have too many people we hate. There's a lot of people that irritate us, you know, and vex us and annoy us and we wish could just improve themselves a little bit, you know? But it's really seeing this arising and passing of selfing and othering together. And as the Buddha says, you know, ill will does not have an independent self-existence. You know, ill will does not have an independent self-existence. That for, you know, the Buddha was very clear, if you want a fire to keep burning, just keep throwing the logs on it. If you want ill will to keep burning, what do? It's a question. Throw on another log. And then the logs are usually our stories, usually our thoughts. You know, usually the way that we weave together an image or weave together an image of the other through our thoughts. If we want to keep ill will burning, throw on the logs. This is why the samadhi element of metta is actually so important. Because we keep learning to actually to do a little bit of less throwing on the logs, to collect our attentiveness around something like an intention or an articulated intention in the phrase. Every moment you're doing that, you are not throwing logs on the fire of ill will. It's that simple. You know, whatever you feed will grow. Whatever you don't feed will cool. So metta is really born out of, I think, this recognition that actually we just simply can't afford ill will. You know, and very much our response to ill will is to have ill will towards the ill will. You know, in particular if you're a meditator, that gets even worse, you know. If I was a good meditator, I wouldn't have all this ill will. But it's very, I think in our minds it's very clear that we simply can't afford this. So you could say that aversion or ill will is the classroom in which we practice and cultivate metta. Not in the best moments of our day, please. That's easy, isn't it? Huh? Surrounded by lovely people, you know, sun shining, birds are singing, filled with metta. You know, that's not difficult. This is not actually the real class. I mean, that's great, do so. Don't feel like you need to avoid it just because there's lots of loveliness around. But our real transformation is really in those moments where ill will or aversion is present. And this is why metta is so foundational, because certainly the biggest shift that I ever see anybody make, either in traditional meditative practice or contemporary mindfulness applications, the biggest shift I ever see anybody make is from aversion to befriending. It's the most transformational shift. It's almost where everything begins to open. Because that's when we stop running, that's when we stop abandoning, that's when we stop fleeing. You know, if you really want to deepen in this practice, just stop hating. It's kind of that simple. Just stop hating. Just stop, you know, engaging in ill will and aversion. So we think about this as our classroom, you know, and I would never suggest to people, it's why I would never suggest with metta practice that you begin with the most difficult person. Let's begin with the little ripples of aversion, the irritations, you know, the annoyances, the impatience, the frustrations, you know, the approachable moments, the bite-sized moments. What is it like in the midst of those moments to really plant that intention? To simply plant that intention. If we were to use, and I think this is, it's good practices, if we were to use the practices of using articulated intentions in terms of phrases, then I think we need to consider and really recognize that human relationship is not the only place that aversion arises. There can be plenty of aversion around events and experiences. The things that annoy us, you know. There can be plenty of aversion around illness, around pain, around unexpected change, around loss. There can be aversion around anything that seems to sort of have the power in some way to injure us, to injure or our well-being. This is, you know, in Buddhist psychology, you know, aversion arises out of fear of injury. This is the breeding ground of aversion, fear of injury. Psychological injury, emotional injury, physical injury. This is actually the breeding ground of aversion. So if we're actually going to take this cultivation on in a kind of inclusive way, it's really not that workable to confine it to just the domains of human relationship. It really needs to be cultivated in the midst of any of those ripples of aversion. Now, in that case, in order for it to be relational, the phrases or the intentions need to change. You know, for example, there would be something quite sort of surreal, wouldn't there, if you were sitting and you were cultivating metta practice in the more traditional ways, you know, friend, benefactor, you know, and your back is killing you and you're trying to hold your benefactor with metta and you're ignoring your back. It doesn't make sense. The back is dukkha, you know. So may my benefactor be happy. It just simply doesn't make sense. So if we are actually to cultivate this practice in an inclusive way, then the phrases need to change. And this is actually what makes metta practice actually accessible for many people who have previously felt excluded. May I be peaceful in the midst of this. May I live with ease and with kindness in the midst of this. In the midst of. You know, whenever we think of metta practice as a state or an emotion, it seems to live almost in opposition or isolation from other states or emotions. But bearing in mind just how very, very relational the cultivation of metta is, in the midst of, is actually what makes it actually quite real and makes it very present moment. In the midst of this, peaceful in the midst of this, then we listen to that. We consider how that lands. You know, that's an investigation. What would it be like for us to be peaceful in the midst of this? What would it be like for us to live with ease or rest with ease and kindness in the midst of this aching back, in the midst of this loss, in the midst of this illness, in the midst of this unwelcome change? I don't know if you remember earlier on, I think it was this morning, I mentioned that sati has four primary dimensions. The first of these is developing the capacity for simple knowing, to know the body as a body, a thought as a thought. This is developing also the attentional element of sati. The second dimension of sati, as I mentioned this morning, is to learn how to be a gatekeeper. This quality of protective awareness. The third dimension of sati is investigative awareness. This is where sati is often likened to a surgeon who's about to undertake an operation. And a skilled surgeon doesn't jump blindly in. They probe the wound to ascertain its nature in order to make a diagnosis, in order to recommend a course of treatment, in order to have a prognosis. This element of sati also comes into metta at this point. Ah, peaceful in the midst of this. What does that look like? What does that feel like? What would that need for that to be so? What would I need to cultivate for that to be so? This investigative nature of metta. The fourth dimension of sati, or mindfulness, is reframing view, or reframing cognition. Okay? It's also reframing perception often. In the early texts, metta is the most direct way of reframing view or reframing perception. How that is happening is that, you know, our views about our enemies are very embedded. Our views about what we can't bear, what we don't want to tolerate, what we don't want to be near, our views about the other are often very embedded. You know, I remember Shirley Jo from 30 years ago when she shouted at me in the playground, you know. And when I see Shirley Jo 30 years later, I am still seeing the Shirley Jo who shouted at me in the playground. You know, she is not allowed to change because that is my view. And she is, you know, Shirley Jo is really the other and really, you know, to some extent my enemy. Metta is about reframing cognition. Maybe there's more to Shirley Jo than that Shirley Jo of 30 years ago who shouted at me in the playground. Maybe Shirley Jo is allowed to change. Goodness me. Maybe that was only a fragment of Shirley Jo. So metta is changing the view of someone or something as an enemy, an opponent, into something or someone that can be approached with an affectionate curiosity. Reframing cognition. Think about what Wittgenstein says when he says, words deliver us a picture and the picture holds us captive. Shirley Jo delivers me a picture and I'm held captive by that picture. And how often that is, how often that is happening in relationship to others, in relationship to ourselves, how view is frozen through aversion. How views are frozen into place through aversion. And how aversion is often involved in just seizing upon the fragment of something or someone or ourselves and mistaking it to be the whole. And we have a view. That's who you are, that's who I am, and that is the nature of the other. That is the nature of the other. And that is kept in place by ill will. So one of the primary jobs in terms of insight, in terms of understanding, and in terms of liberation, is reframing view or reframing cognition. It doesn't mean that difficult people are suddenly transported into being lovely people. You know, they may still be difficult people, you know, but they are allowed to change. You know, they are allowed maybe not to be difficult somewhere else. They are not frozen into being the other. So we don't think of metta practice as a way of, you know, fixing people. But we do think of metta practice as a way of beginning to melt our views, beginning to soften our views that freeze or solidify people or parts of ourselves or parts of our lives into things, into the other, into the something or someone. Any reflections, questions about that? Please, yeah. Absolutely. If you want to change a verb into a noun, add some clinging and form a view. And if you want to change a process into a state, add some clinging and form a view. You can get a sense of that in our lives, can't you? You know how, and often how we want to form views, because it almost gives us a position to occupy in relationship to the other. You know, whether it's safe or not safe, whether we like them or not like them. But of course, when we solidify someone else through a view, we also solidify and freeze our relationship to that person. So it's not only that they're that kind of despicable person. I am frozen into a relationship of ill will in relationship to them. So there's this simultaneous kind of reifying. Yeah. Yes, please. Do you remember, I think I mentioned it today, but maybe yesterday, the continuum process, that clinging is only a magnification of craving and aversion. It's only an intensification. It's not a separate phenomena. It's simply a concentration of craving and aversion, turns craving and aversion into something quite solid and stuck, and that is what, and contracted. And that's what we call clinging. And the view of self and the view of other is really only a continuum of that clinging. Again, not a sort of separate phenomena, but an intensification of one phenomena. Yes, please.
So if I can never quite see the whole, because I have a perception, I see someone, I see through my lens, whatever that is. So why not see them, it's kind of like giving people the benefit of the doubt, just saying yes to whatever they are, and being friendly for that.
It's partial.
Limited.
Yeah, it's selective.
So in that selective.
I mean, you think about all the ways that we have of kind of solidifying people. You know, it might be through judgment, it might be through blame, it might be through ill will. Yeah, well, they're all manifestations of ill will. You know, perhaps you could take that one step further and maybe question whether there even is such a thing as a whole. You know, the whole of a person, you know, or the whole of ourselves. I mean, I find myself wondering whether there even is such a thing. I mean, if in reality, you know, we unfreeze ourselves from the clinging mechanisms that kind of put everything in place, I mean, what then is enabled, or what then is visible, or what then is seen, is that, you know, as human beings, we're constantly changing. You know, we're learning, we're developing, things are being let go of, things are being nurtured, you know. We're not ever static, a whole, you know. And hopefully we can begin to appreciate the dynamic nature of simply being a human being or another person being a human being, which is, of course, it's that dynamic nature that makes anything possible. You know, to see the whole almost sounds to me like there's a conclusion, you know. There's an arrival point, you know, where, oh, now I've got the whole, you know, I've got the whole of someone, or I've got the whole of myself. You know, perhaps there isn't such a thing as a whole. You know, perhaps there is a process which is, you know, being enriched or being undermined by many, many different factors. But it's almost like to see the whole is almost like we've arrived at a conclusion where we're kind of saying, oh, now I know you, you know, or now I see you. Maybe we don't, you know? And maybe in that, we, you know, our learning is to be so mindful of the lens through which we're seeing, whether it's a lens of ill will, of anxiety, or fear, or whether it's a lens of befriending and affectionate curiosity that actually enables that dynamic fluid process of unfolding to actually be okay for us, you know, and okay within us. But we're aware of the lens, and we're aware of the selectivity of our attention and how we're constantly trying to form bonds with people based on some commonality of likes, preferences, dislikes, you know, histories, you know, shared experience, where we're constantly trying to form bonds of commonality so that someone means something to us. You know, and in a way, this is what metta practice is about, which is why, you know, these traditional domains of human relationship are actually quite valuable, because they actually take away that sort of, you know, I will befriend those that I have a shared history with and shared preferences with, and actually I'm going to start to look at these domains of, you know, the neutral person or the you know, the difficult person. What is it like to actually develop metta in those classrooms, you know? And you know, the neutral person is, as I mentioned earlier, the practice that I've been engaging with. But it's very much paralleled, isn't it, by our relationship to neutral feeling tones in life. You know, we gravitate towards the pleasant, we move away from the unpleasant, and that which is neither perceptibly pleasant or unpleasant, we basically ignore. We basically ignore. And what we discover sort of in Satipatthana practice is that when we pay attention to that which is neither pleasant or unpleasant, it doesn't stay that way. When we actually attend to neutral people in our life, they don't stay neutral. That doesn't mean they have to fit into some new category of being a friend or being a difficult person. You know, they don't have to fit into a new category. They're simply not neutral anymore. Yeah. The question is how metta interfaces with non-attachment. Well, attachment is, you know, traditionally said to be the sort of near enemy of metta. You know that, but it's such a difficult word. You know that, you know, because you know, in terms of Western psychological understanding, we all know how important healthy attachments are. You know, to the growth of anyone, you know, to the growth of an infant, to the growth of a relationship, you know, healthy attachments are actually really, really important. I would prefer to move in the direction of non-clinging rather than non-attachment. I just feel like it's a loaded term. Let's talk about clinging rather than attachment. You know, I would hate to tell a young child not to be attached to their parents, or a parent not to be attached to their children. You know, I personally, I don't think it's a good translation, you know. I just don't think it's a good translation. I think it's much more helpful to think in terms of non-clinging rather than non-attachment. You know, it's so much kind of smacks of kind of, I think, in myths, at least in some people's minds, around non-caring. You know, which is completely the opposite of metta. Yes, please. But this is where they do matter. This is actually where they do matter. You know, I mean, metta is a kind of willingness to be intimate. It's a willingness to stand near to all things. And I so understand, you know, and I hear it from a number of people that, you know, in like really difficult times, you know, the kind of inclination to retreat and to withdraw and to shut down in some ways is in some ways so human, you know, the fear of just being overwhelmed and swamped by it all. And you know, when I said that metta is to stand near to things, I think all of us need to determine at different times in our days, in a week, how close, how near we can actually stand without getting burned. And that's going to have something to do with how well resourced we are inwardly. You know, if we're not well resourced inwardly, you know, resourced with practice, resourced with enough sleep, you know, resourced with enough health, resourced with enough joy, to stand too near to the difficult often will result in a feeling of being swamped or overwhelmed. And I don't think there's a great deal of learning that comes out of being overwhelmed. But then if we see that we're under-resourced, you know, one of the most direct applications of metta might be looking at how we would then resource ourselves so that our eyes and our hearts can open to the spectrum of the terrible and the difficult in our world without being overwhelmed. So this is a changing landscape. It's a changing landscape. How near we can stand to the difficult is actually very much related to inner resourcefulness. So I would just really encourage you not to take a position in closing down and retreating. That might be true and valid in one moment, and it might be a signal of the need to find a greater sense of being resourced inwardly, so actually we don't, so that we don't surrender the ways in which we are really asked to be, in my understanding, an engaged and conscious, compassionate participant in the healing of our world. There was, you know, it was very important at certain points in our evolutionary history that we actually knew who was out to eat us, you know, who was out to eat us, who was out to, you know, steal our water hole. I mean, it was very important at some point. It's gone far beyond this now. You know, we have a different brain than we had, you know, 30,000 years ago. We actually have physiologically a different brain. But we're doing the same patterns.
I was thinking of the research with hunter-gatherers, that they had small groups and they had to know who they could count on.
Yeah.
I mean, they had to fix it. So I'm just commenting that there's some, maybe there's some biological reason that...
You know what? Survival mechanisms are built for survival. They're not built for happiness. This is the difference.
Yeah, that would be a good reminder for me.
Yeah, survival mechanisms are built for survival. They're not built for happiness. Yeah. Yeah, one last time, then I think we'll have some time to move. Yeah. Yeah. I think we need to accept we are always seeing the world through a particular lens. You know? And surprisingly, I say this, unsurprisingly, as human beings, we are very often reluctant to be surprised. Well, would it prove us wrong, or would it help us to examine more closely whether our views are actually getting in the way of seeing something as fluidly as we're able to? But we could interpret that as being seen as being wrong. That would be the aversion element. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be wrong, of course my view is right. Okay, so let's take some time, I think half an hour, for some walking. You're probably ready to move, aren't you? Then we'll come back and we'll continue this discussion.